Good evening, ladies and gentlemen of the radio audience. We are about to broadcast from the War Department building at Washington, D.C., the addresses incidental to the Special Defense Test Day program. This is station WCAP, Washington, WEAF, New York, WJAR, Providence, WNAC, Boston, WOO, Philadelphia, WGY, Schenectady, WGR, Buffalo, KDKA, Pittsburgh, WSB, Atlanta, WLW, Cincinnati, WGN, Chicago, KSD, St. Louis, WDAF, Kansas City, WLAG, Minneapolis, WOAW, Omaha, WFAA, Dallas, KLZ, Denver, and KGO, Oakland, California. Today is National Defense Test Day, and throughout our United States, in every city, village, town, and hamlet, were gathered citizens from all walks of life in answer to the Defense Day call. Reports have been received from every section, and they show that the response to the Defense Test Day summons has been most complete and successful. Here in Washington, the answer to the Defense Test Day call was really wonderful. This morning, all officers of the United States Army, regular, National Guard, and organized reserves within the District of Columbia reported at their proper posts, ready for duty. The patriotic demonstration here today was a pleasure to witness. There was an immense parade, which started early in the afternoon and lasted throughout the balance of the day. Marching bodies of all three components of the Army of the United States and of the civic organizations of the district paraded through the streets. The President reviewed this great parade, and the Secretary of War and General Pershing addressed the great mass of people which assembled on the monument grounds in the shadow of the monument erected to the first defender of our country, General George Washington. The spirit of cooperation and interest shown by the people was very keen and made you realize that they understood and appreciated the National Defense Test Day. And now we have come to the closing exercises of the National Defense Day. Gathered here in the War Department building in the office of the Secretary of War is a very distinguished audience, among whom are the Honorable John Wingate Weeks, Secretary of War, Honorable Dwight F. Davis, Assistant Secretary of War, General John J. Pershing, Theodore Roosevelt, Assistant Secretary of the Navy, Admiral Edward W. Eberle, Major General John L. Hines, Deputy Chief of Staff, who tomorrow will succeed General Pershing as Chief of Staff of the Army, Brigadier General Dennis Nolan, who succeeds General Hines as Deputy Chief of Staff, Major General John A. Lejeune, Brigadier General J.J. Carty, Major General Charles McKinley Saltzman, Brigadier General U.A. Drum, and many other notables of our Army and Navy, famous for their achievements during the World War, and in bringing to a happy conclusion the answer to the first defense call, April 6, 1917. The program this evening will be of special interest to the radio audience. We will have the pleasure of listening to an address by the Secretary of War and by General John J. Pershing, and by General John J. Carty. Major General Charles McKinley Saltzman, Chief Signal Officer of the United States Army, will also make a few short remarks and will introduce the speakers of the evening. General Carty's address. During General Carty's address, there will be an especially interesting feature to the radio audience. General Carty will call by long-distance wires the commanding generals of some of the core areas, and we will have the pleasure of listening again to General Pershing talk with these generals, and we will be able to hear in response to this call the remarks made by a number of our most famous generals whose names are well known to our radio audience for their achievements during the World War. The remarks of the generals at the various corps area will be carried to Washington and back to each broadcasting station by long-distance wires and broadcast. The program is about ready to start now, so the next voice that you will hear will be that of Major General Charles McKinley Saltzman.
Emergency and the duty of the citizen and the local community in event of mobilization. To the representatives of the people charged with the responsibility of leadership in time of an emergency, the test will indicate the defects in our plans for defending the nation. I hope all of you have seen the ceremonies in your home communities. The sum total of these demonstrations represents the national demonstration. This demonstration has been a public report by the War Department to its owners of the execution of the National Defense Act of 1920. The act itself sets forth the basic military policy of the country. The general nature of this policy is rather well indicated by three short extracts from the act, which I think I should read to you now. The organized peace establishment, including the regular army, the National Guard and the organized reserves, shall include all of those divisions and other military organizations necessary to form the basis for a complete and immediate mobilization for the national defense in the event of a national emergency declared by Congress. Second, the duties of the War Department General Staff shall be to prepare plans for the national defense and the use of the military forces for that purpose, both separately and in conjunction with the naval forces, and for the mobilization of the manpower of the nation and its material resources in an emergency, to investigate and report upon all questions affecting the efficiency of the Army of the United States and its state of preparation for military operations. Third, the Chief of Staff shall preside over the War Department General Staff and shall cause to be made the necessary plans for recruiting, organizing, supplying, equipping, mobilizing, training and demobilizing the Army of the United States. Upon the approval of such plans by the Secretary of War, he shall act as agent of the government in carrying the same into effect. The question has been asked by some persons who are not opposed to the national military policy prescribed by Congress as to why it is necessary to hold a public demonstration in order to carry that policy into effect. Such persons overlook the fact that the sections which I have just quoted require the War Department to make plans and then report upon their efficiency. Unless these plans are tested, such a report would be purely theoretical and of doubtful value. The object of the defense test has been to test the plans so that the report required by law may be of some value. Moreover, it must be remembered that in the event of a real national emergency, everyone within the range of my voice tonight must necessarily have some special task to perform in connection with the national defense. That task cannot be well performed unless it has been practiced. The test has given all of you an opportunity to have some sort of practice in the task which any great national emergency would necessarily impose upon you. The defense test has not had the effect on foreign nations anticipated by the pacifists. who predicted that it would tend to cause alarm and increase military armaments. Of course, we knew from the first that other nations would pay no attention to it. They know how small our army really is, and that for all aggressive purposes, we are disarmed. There has been more talk about disarmament in Europe during the last month than ever before in the world's history, and the opponents of the defense test should be willing to admit that they were mistaken in their prophecy. How is the defense test a materialistic gesture? Do any of you feel militarized by this event? Has any citizen of the United States been made more willing by the demonstration of today, either to submit to military tyranny at home or to engage in military expeditions abroad? The question is its own answer. The idea that the defense test would militarize the country is a mere figment of the imagination. As for the defense test being a war measure, I feel justified in saying that nobody is more desirous than myself of preventing war, with the possible exception of General Pershing and the brave men who served with him in France. My desires, however, do not blind my judgment. Peace at home and abroad has always required trained men in uniform. The more efficient they are, the more securely is peace preserved. Insofar as the defense test has contributed to the efficiency of our small uniformed forces, it has been a very constructive measure for the maintenance of domestic and international peace. The action taken today has not been a mobilization. It has been an inspection. Every year we mobilize our battle fleet for practice, as does every other nation. And it has been the practice of European nations to assemble their military forces for the same purpose. That is a mobilization. This has simply been the inspection of local forces assembled in their home communities. It has none of the elements of a general mobilization, as the term is understood throughout the world. Today, as you see, partially represented the new Army of the United States, it seems fitting to remind you that practically the entire reorganization of our land defense forces under the Act of 1920 has been directed by General Pershing. Tomorrow, this distinguished American will be retired from the active list of the Army. He goes with the soldier's satisfaction of having served his country admirably. In the Philippines, in Cuba, and in Mexico, he acquitted himself with distinction. As Commander-in-Chief of the American Expeditionary Forces, General Pershing successfully executed the greatest military problem that ever confronted this country. He commanded the largest body of men ever assembled under the American flag. It was necessary for him to face terrific pressure abroad and to bear the responsibility for critical decisions. He never wavered from the American purpose that it was wiser to strike for victory with an American army. 6 years ago today, he justified his policy and determination. On that day, troops of the United States Army went forward to victory at San Mateo and showed friend and foe alike what might be expected of trained American forces in action. History will accord General Pershing a place among the great military leaders of all time. Future generations will be inspired by his career and by the contributions made to the progress of the world by his mind and will. There is little in the way of honor that our national organization permits the government to give to its outstanding servants. Old age advances. The years spent in loyal service by these men become but memories. It is not possible to retain them in positions of prominence. They are left with their memories and their reminiscences to pass through the declining years. And it is only too true that the nation itself often forgets what is due to its soldiers and sailors. Only historians keep alive the names of the great men of the past. Other countries find a way to make use of the advice, experience, and wisdom of their outstanding public servants. Our best means of paying tribute to General Pershing, of recognizing our debt to him, of honoring him, is to take up now the task which he is compelled to relinquish. He has organized a new army, an army of citizens. In future, as we have today, let us support his policy and continue to carry out his well-laid plans. By doing this, we will give him the satisfaction of knowing that he has built the new defense policy on a sure foundation. We will give him the pleasure of seeing well served and well defended the great republic whose service and to whose defense he has devoted his unselfish efforts throughout his life. This is also an appropriate occasion for me to express my personal thanks to General Pershing for the support I have received from him while at the head of the War Department. When I needed advice, I have received from him able and disinterested advice. When I needed the execution of an order, I have received the most faithful and loyal execution of that order. It is a source of the utmost regret to me that I am about to lose his services as Chief of Staff. It is a great gratification to me, however, that I will be able hereafter to obtain his valuable advice, even though it be given in an unofficial capacity. All the world knows the value of the services which the General rendered to the country in France. Only a few of us have been privileged to know the real value of the services which he has rendered since the war. Those of us who have that knowledge consider him as valuable to the country in peace as he was in war. I now have the privilege to present to you the nation's foremost soldier, whom we all delight to honor tonight, General John J. Pershing.
I feel truly grateful to you, Mr. Secretary, for your very complimentary remarks concerning my humble services, but must say that whatever credit may be given me must be equally shared by the loyal and efficient officers and men with whom I have been associated, and especially by those who served in our armies in the World War. It was the patriotic and aggressive spirit of the young manhood of America that carried our banners to victory on the battlefields of the Old World. It is to them, my comrades, to whom the praise should go. The calamity of war has always come upon us unawares, and has without exception found us wholly deficient in preparation. Consequently, our experience in all wars has been very bitter, the loss of life always excessive, and the burden of debt extremely heavy. The World War was no exception, with its inevitable delay, turmoil, and confusion. The difficulties of providing modern equipment of aviation and artillery, together with other supplies, demanded the most extravagant outlay of money. While the tremendous task of drafting, organizing, and training officers and men fresh from the farms and workshops, and the construction of shipping to transport them to the field of conflict extended over a period of time, such a period of time that the war might have been lost but for the tenacity of our allies. In this crisis, many of our inadequately prepared men had to be thrown in to save the situation. Realizing the consequences of our previous neglect, perhaps as much as any other person, it appeared to me a matter of grave importance that we should take steps to avoid a repetition of this sad experience and profit by the lessons it taught. By the end of the war, our divisions had become veterans with fine esprit de corps and splendid traditions, which, if preserved, would be an inspiration to our people, especially to those who might be called upon to bear arms for us in the future. With this idea in mind, the matter was presented to Congress, and the law of 1920 was passed. The act, which embraces this conception, provides for a force of three components: the regular army, the National Guard, with its World War units on the peace footing, maintained by the states to preserve law and order, but subject to federal service, and the reserves, mainly skeletonized units of the World War, with officers only who are called out for active service in an extreme emergency. The peace units of each of these categories are distributed according to population throughout the country, generally down to companies. The officers and men of each unit are eventually to be chosen as far as possible from the community. Thus, in the event of a call, these units would be composed of men from the same town or neighborhood and would be equipped, supplied, and sheltered, also trained largely in the locality. This is a very different plan from the one adopted at the beginning of the World War, through which, for the lack of previous consideration, all of our men were drafted and, after much delay, sent to distant, unfinished cantonments among strangers, under officers with but little, if any, experience, and there were eventually segregated, organized, and trained for combat. The units of the National Guard and Reserves are now officered mainly by those who served in the World War, but the time is rapidly approaching when men with this exceptional experience will have passed out. So we are instructing young men in camps and colleges with the idea that they may gradually fill the vacancies as they occur and there receive the inspiration and the impulse to carry out the traditions and maintain the standards of those old war units. It is to be noted in this connection that in addition to the military instruction of these prospective officers, they are taught the elementary principles of civil government and are given a course in the duties of citizenship. Generally speaking, the training in these camps is exactly what every young man should have under any circumstances. It inculcates respect for authority and clear ideas of discipline. It teaches self-respect and develops a strong physique. No one can visit one of these camps or colleges where military instruction is given and not be impressed by the wisdom of this sort of training. Even though these young men should never be called to the colors, the benefits that accrue to the country and to themselves are so valuable that the small annual outlay is negligible. The test today has been simply a preliminary exercise in order to acquaint all concerned with the specific duties they would be called upon to perform in case of actual mobilization. Instead of leaving such matters at haphazard, the system fixes upon these citizen officers the responsibility of putting their organizations in shape for service. We, your servants, are trying to carry out your will, but your support must be given. It is your country and your responsibility. Each man and woman within the sound of my voice has just as much of an obligation in this matter as I have, and the importance of the question demands your constant interest. It is your boy, perhaps, who must suffer through your failure to provide the means by which he may be given a fighting chance. There is no war cloud on the horizon, so far as we can discern, but storms often appear out of a clear sky, and then it may be too late to prepare. a sensible people should need no further lessons than those based upon experience. As I see it, the defense of one's country is a religious as well as a patriotic duty. No man can be faithful to his religious obligations and fail in his duty to the nation. They go hand in hand. And if it is a religious duty to defend one's country and one's home, it is equally an obligation to prepare for the purpose. We're a peace-loving people, and the whole world knows it, but wanton neglect of a consideration of the question of defense will not prevent war. Human nature has not changed, and the millennium has not yet arrived. To dream of peace is not a guarantee against war. While striving for peace, always, let us not forget to guard against an evil day. The very limited forces we maintain are relatively several times smaller than those of any other nation and are negligible in comparison with the leading countries. Today, we are at the lowest limit we should ever be under any circumstances, and we cannot go lower without reverting to our pre-war status. Let us be wise in our generation that those who follow us may not suffer the misfortune that was ours. The system of defense that we stand for, with its foundation laid in the homes, will become the best assurance for the solidity of the nation and the surest guarantee of peace that could be devised. It is with the greatest satisfaction that during the closing years of my service in the Army, I have been associated with the Honorable John W. Weeks as Secretary of War. His administration has been marked by great interest in the development of a rational system of defense. And it is only fair to say that if it had not been for his clear conception of the scheme and his active support, the success of the plans would not have been possible. It is a pleasure to me to state before the audience who are listening to me tonight that I leave my office as Chief of Staff regarding John W. Weeks as one of the ablest, if not the ablest, secretary we have ever had, and one whom I delight to call my friend. The wonderful telephone and broadcasting arrangements made under the direction of Brigadier General Carty for the American Telephone and Telegraph Company afford a very striking example of mobilization and represent their contribution to Defense Day. We are all under great obligations to the experts who made this broadcasting possible. As this will be the last opportunity I shall have during my service on the active list of the Army, I cannot close my remarks without expressing to this vast audience my sincere thanks for the courtesies so universally extended to me by my countrymen and for the confidence they have always given me. I thank you.
This is the War Department broadcasting certain features of the Defense Test Day program in Washington. You have just had the privilege of listening to an address by General Pershing, the General of the Armies of our country. In a few moments, there will be another interesting feature of this program broadcasted, in which you will hear General Pershing speak again. But first, you will have the privilege of listening to another general officer of our Army, one who served during the World's War and rendered very distinguished services in the building up of a great communication service for General Pershing's forces in France. The next voice that you hear will be the voice of that officer, Brigadier General John J. Carty of the Officers Reserve Corps.
The problem of national defense concerns all of our people, and the plans for a great emergency must provide for the utilization of all of our industrial activities. No plan for the national defense can be successful unless it provides for an adequate system of electrical communications. Even if millions of men had been trained and were ready to serve, even if all of the necessary supplies and equipment were available for a great national emergency, the activities of our government and of the people would be paralyzed without electrical communications. Every day of our lives, minor emergencies occur among us, in the home and in the office, in the factory and on the farm, on the highway and on the seas. In all these cases, we have instant recourse to electrical communications. In case of accident or sickness, we send calls for medical aid. In case of fire or acts of violence, we call for the fire or for the police department. To meet all these emergencies, electrical communications are employed. Still greater emergencies caused by floods, tornadoes, or conflagrations oftentimes afflict entire communities. And here, the first concern of the authorities is to establish electrical communications with the devastated area. In a great emergency affecting all of our homes and all of our communities and all of the people of our country, nationwide electrical communications are of first importance, for upon them depend the carrying out of the necessary measures of relief or defense. It is necessary and appropriate, therefore, that on this day we should conduct a test of our country's electrical communications to determine their adequacy for the national defense. Throughout the entire nation, even in the most distant sections, the power of our national system of electrical communications has been manifested. Even in the most remote communities, among the mountains and in the valleys, and by those upon the sea, the voice of Secretary Weeks and of General Pershing has been heard speaking from the seat of government at Washington. Never before has it been possible for so many people distributed over such a vast area to hear at the same moment the voice of a speaker. This exhibits the marvels of radio, and everyone within the borders of the United States who is listening tonight is carrying out not only the purposes of the Defense Day test, but is participating in an historic event. The use of radio in the national defense are many, but one of its special functions is to carry instantly to all of our citizens a national proclamation or a call or a message directed to the people at large. For carrying the countless messages of intercommunication to and from Washington to all parts of the land, and among the different towns and cities and villages of the country, wires are employed. You are listening by radio to but a few of the messages carried by the wires, for it would be impossible for you to hear them all, because they are so numerous, and because so many thousands of them are passing at the same time. Omitting the great volume of messages carried over the telegraph wires, there passes each day over the telephone wires of the United States a grand total of 59 million messages. The indications are that today, even this vast total has been exceeded. In handling this great volume of traffic, 45 million miles of wire have been in action, and their availability for service has been demonstrated, should they be required in the national defense. This wire system is spread over the country like a great net covering the entire nation. This network embraces more than 20,000 telephone central offices distributed throughout all of the states in the Union and provides intercommunication between more than 15 million telephone stations. From Washington, direct wire connections can be established with any of these stations, and messages can be sent from any one of these stations to any other. Employed in this intercommunication system, there has been on duty today throughout the United States 425,000 men and women. From the nature of their everyday employment, these men and women are accustomed to the duty of establishing electrical communications in countless cases of emergency. And in meeting the ordinary demands upon them, they have become well-disciplined in performing their function of serving the public. This Defense Day test has demonstrated that they can be depended upon to perform any duty within their power which might devolve upon them under the plans to expand the signal corps in case of a great national emergency. In order that you should hear the address this evening, 19 radio stations have been called into service, and 38,000 miles of wire are employed to carry the voices of the speakers at Washington to these stations located in all sections of the country. From these radio stations, the words are carried direct to your ears. It is possible to hold a conversation over the long-distance wires between Washington and any point in the United States. Because the radio stations are connected to the wires over which I am now talking, it is possible for all of those who are listening by radio to hear the conversation. To illustrate in a practical manner the functions of communications, I will now call over the long-distance wires a number of cities and towns extending from the Atlantic seaboard westward to the Pacific, placing all of them in direct wire communication with this room at Washington. Tonight, the radio stations are connected to these wires so that the radio listeners may hear the conversation taking place over them. In the event of a national emergency, such messages would not be heard by the radio listeners, but only reach the individuals for whom they were intended. I will now begin to call up the different points, and I will start at New York. I will call first New York.
New York, telephone office.
Harrisburg, Pennsylvania.
Harrisburg, telephone office.
Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Pittsburgh, telephone office.
Beaver Dam, Ohio.
Beaver Dam, telephone office.
Chicago.
Chicago, telephone office.
Davenport, Iowa.
Davenport, telephone office.
Omaha, Nebraska.
Omaha, telephone office.
North Platte, Nebraska.
North Platte, telephone office.
Denver, Colorado.
Denver, telephone office.
Rawlins, Wyoming.
Rawlins, telephone office.
Salt Lake City, Utah.
Salt Lake City, telephone office.
Winnemucca, Nevada.
Winnemucca, telephone office.
Sacramento, California.
Sacramento, telephone office.
San Francisco, California.
San Francisco, telephone office.
San Francisco, I hear you very well indeed. How do you hear me?
I hear you perfectly, General.
That's good. What time is it in San Francisco now?
It is now 4 minutes after 7.
Is it dark there?
It is very nearly dark. The sun has just set beyond the Golden Gate a few moments ago.
Well, we'd been a little bit earlier. We might have caught up with it.
You were just a few moments late, General.
San Francisco.
Yes,
I wish to have you connect make some connection for me there. Will you connect Major General Morton, commanding the 9th Corps area? Put him on the wire.
At once, sir.